This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the Chief Commercial Officer of Ascent Aviation Services, one of the largest aircraft maintenance, storage, and reclamation operations in the world. A lot of aircraft are now in storage, and getting them prepped, maintained, and released for service is more complicated than you might think. In the news, members have been selected by the FAA for the new Women in Aviation Advisory Board, the fatal crash of a Canadian snowbird, the Cessna Sky Courier takes first flight, airline passenger policies for wearing masks, and Airbus looks to a downsized future. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 604 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI of the year, and he's our resident Cirrus aircraft expert. Hey, Max.
Hello, Max. I'm also shooting for the beard record, so when it gets down to my knees, I'll let you know.
You're outgrowing me. Well, I trimmed mine yesterday a little bit too, because I'm kind of going for the not too long look, you know.
You're looking good, sir.
I'm trying. Also with us, pretty much I think without facial hair, as far as I can tell here, is Rob Mark. He's senior editor of Flying Magazine. He's publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Oh, weren't you going to say, good evening, Rob? I was waiting for that. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to watch you stumble around.
Oh, I see. Okay, that was really nice. And listen, thank you for inviting me to fill in for our co-host, David V. I was going to have a history segment, but I thought, you know, really, I mean, I don't want to make David feel bad by coming up with something that would be really embarrassing because I don't know anything about history. It'd
be tough to compete.
Yeah, it would. Get better, David.
David is off this week. He should be returning soon, though. Our guest this episode is Scott Butler. He's Chief Commercial Officer for Ascent Aviation Services. They're one of the largest aircraft maintenance, storage, and reclamation operations in the world. They provide fully integrated solutions. We mentioned overhaul and repair, MRO, line maintenance, storage. We're going to be talking a lot about that. They do reclamation paint, interior services. And they do this for owners and operators and lessors of wide-body, narrow-body, and regional aircraft. Ascent Aviation Services currently operates two maintenance facilities that cover more than 1,250 acres, five hangars, all in southern Arizona. The company is a Class 4, 14 CFR Part 145 certified repair station, and they maintain approvals and certifications from regulatory authorities globally. As for Scott, he's an aviation professional. He has more than 10 years with the aerospace industry. Before he joined Ascent Aviation Services, he was the director of sales for Zodiac Aerospace, which was owned by Safran since February 2018. Of course, they offer aero systems and cabin interiors and seats. Scott's held leadership positions in program management, in engineering and operations management at TE Connectivity and Rockwell Collins. He holds a degree in aviation human factors and aerospace engineering from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's also a licensed multi-engine pilot. So, Scott, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen.
Now, we've been talking about the impact of the pandemic on the airlines, and, of course, we know that a lot of aircraft, most of the aircraft, have been taken out of service and are in storage in various places. And, Scott, I assume that a sizable number of those aircraft are with your operation.
Yeah, that's correct. Currently, we're managing over 400 aircraft between both facilities. our one facility on Tucson Airport. It can house about 50 or 60 aircraft. It's more for the narrow body maintenance. But our larger facility on Pinal Air Park in Marana, about 30 miles away from Tucson Airport, has the big swath of desert there. And we're over 400 aircraft as of today.
It's just amazing. I'm sure you folks are pretty busy these days with lots to do. Well, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week first, and then we'll focus in on Scott and Ascent Aviation Services. So let's start with the news. And is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, it's hard to find aviation news that isn't related to the COVID pandemic, but we'll take a brief break from that and start with a few virus-free news items. First comes from eTurbo News. This is U.S. aviation industry leaders appointed to Women in Aviation Advisory Board. Now, this board, the WIAAB, the Women in Aviation Advisory Board, was established last year, October 2019, under the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018. The FAA states the objective of the board as, quote, the objective is to develop and provide independent recommendations and strategies to the FAA to explore opportunities for encouraging and supporting female students and aviators to pursue a career in aviation, with the objective of promoting organizations and programs that are providing education, training, mentorship, outreach, and recruitment of women for positions in the aviation industry. And so what we see is Elaine Chao, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, has just announced the 30 board members that have been appointed. And it's a pretty remarkable list. I mean, there are some pretty successful, high-powered women in this group making up the new advisory board. I think all 30 of them are women. I don't think there are actually any men in the list, but it's a pretty impressive list.
Somehow I'm thinking we probably wouldn't want to make this our protest movement about where is the token male or something like that. Because these ladies know what they're doing. In fact, I was chatting with one of them yesterday, Amy Spohrt from the National Aviation Hall of Fame, and she didn't even mention this. And so when I saw it this morning, I said, how come you didn't mention that to me last night when we were on the phone? And she said, oh, I don't know. I guess I just forgot. And I said, this is pretty cool. And they've got what the former Air Force chief, Secretary of the Air Force, I think.
It is a pretty extensive list. There's Marianne DeMarco from the Coalition of Airline Pilots Associations, folks like Patricia Gilbert. She's the executive VP of NATCA, Jean Lydon Rogers, president and CEO of GE Aviation Services. I mean, these are just a few of the women. Allison McKay, CEO and president, Women in Aviation International. Colonel Martha Morris from the Civil Air Patrol. Tammy Jo Schultz, who's the Southwest Airlines captain that was flying the that plane that had the uncontained engine failure and one fatality. She's on the board. Pamela Williams, Human Resources Board of Directors for the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. So it's and that's just a sampling. It is quite a group. The board will be chaired by Heather Wilson, who is the president of the University of Texas at El Paso. I don't know what the timeline is. The FAA says that the board will submit a report that contains, quote, a comprehensive plan to the FAA administrator and appropriate committees of Congress. But I don't know if a timeline has been established.
Well, we know that initially this was required by the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018. So that was probably, what, about 16, 18 months ago when that act was passed. So it took them a while, I think, to get to this point. But that act, to be fair to the FAA, was just full of dozens and dozens of different kinds of initiatives that Congress required them to implement. So great that they're getting to this one.
And if you wonder how did these board members get selected, well, the FAA solicited nominations through a Federal Register notice in October 2019, and reportedly almost 200 applicant packages were submitted. And I guess from them, the FAA selected this group of 30. So, yeah, really looking forward to this. I don't know if this is one of those kinds of things where we'll see some reports of progress being made along the way, or if we'll have to wait for the final report or what. I don't know.
Well, women are such better networkers, I have found, in this industry than we guys ever could be. I mean, we know a lot of people because we're guys, but we're scattered all over the place. And honestly, I mean, when I the first time I went to a convention for women in aviation, and I looked at the agendas for the programs and the speakers, and I went, "Holy smokes, these ladies are organized, and they really do go out of their way to help each other." And I think we're going to see some of that shake out of this whole thing. Again, I agree with you, though. I don't know how long that's going to take.
Yeah, I think some interesting things, some good things will probably come out of this. All right, we'll move on to some not so great news. This is a CAF member who died in snowbird plane crash identified. And as you may know, one of the Canadian snowbirds planes crashed in Kamloops, British Columbia. That team was on a tour of the country under Operation Inspiration, which is similar sounding to the U.S. tour of the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds. Well, the Royal Canadian Air Force CT-114 Tudor with Captain Richard McDougall and Captain Jennifer Casey on board had just lifted off, and something went wrong. Captain Casey was killed. Captain McDougall sustained serious but reportedly not life-threatening injuries, and the plane crashed into a house in a residential neighborhood. There are at least two videos taken from different angles as the planes were, because there were two of them, taking off. And it's hard to tell. I don't know. You got the three of you are pilots. I don't know. Maybe you have some thoughts on some of the videos that we've seen.
I was kind of intrigued by watching that aircraft. The two of them were together, and as they reached, I don't know, a couple thousand feet in the air, the accident aircraft seemed to kind of peel off from the others and then start to do a couple turns as it was headed toward the ground. It certainly never looked like it got slow enough to be in a stall spin. It was not turning at a rate that I would expect from a stall spin. It almost seemed as if there were some type of control failure in some kind of way. I just couldn't understand why it would divert what seemed like from a fairly normal flight path to doing a few turns and pointing toward the ground. Very hard to understand.
Yeah, makes you wonder if there's some kind of power plant issue or loss of power there and maybe trying to turn back to a safer area. But yeah, it didn't look right. Like you said, it kind of looked like a last-ditch maneuver.
Max East and I were talking about this last night, and it looked like when whatever happened, the pilot sucked the stick back in his gut to get some altitude, to trade speed for altitude. But I kept waiting for him to push the nose back over to level the airplane out, and it never did, and it just fell off on one wing. It, to me, at least when I looked at the video, it looked like it entered maybe half of a turn in a spin, and then it went straight down. But they weren't very high off the ground. And it looked like, I wasn't sure if they said later that both pilots ejected, but they were pretty low to the ground when they did. And, you know, whether the woman in the back's chute had time to open, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen any of those details.
Yeah, I saw in the video kind of two puffs from the canopy, and I don't know if that was both seats ejecting or if one of those was the canopy blowing. I don't really know. Don't really know.
No, you couldn't really tell. I mean, I don't know enough about what we should see in a standard ejection to know what we were looking at. But again, that close to the ground, oh my God. And as we talked last night, some of the ground around there, I guess, is high. And so I guess there weren't that many places to go. But still, maybe they were trying to turn around. I don't know. But if they were going to turn around, they would have had to shove that nose over way quicker to maintain some kind of airspeed. And that just never happened.
Yeah. And the plane came down. It was a pretty heavily residential area. And the report that I saw said there were no injuries on the ground. I think there might have been some people in the house, but I heard one report that an elderly couple escaped out the back door and were not injured. But this is so fresh that the facts are really not completely established yet. So I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this.
Now, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of data out, and some of the stories I saw seemed a little contradictory. I thought one suggested that the pilot, you know, rode the airplane down while the lady who died had punched out. But again, I didn't believe that when I read that, and I think we'll hear more about this. My recollection is that the Snowbirds had another accident sometime within the last couple of years. Do you folks remember that?
Yeah, they did. What did we talk about last night, Max? Was it someplace in Georgia, I think, that they lost one not long after takeoff too, I believe.
Yeah, and I don't know if the circumstances were similar to this or what. I haven't researched that.
Sure enough, so that was at the Atlanta Air Show in 2019. Looks like it was in the October timeframe. Hmm.
All right, well, let's move on. This is an article in Flying Magazine, authored by our very own Rob Mark. This is Cessna Sky Courier successfully completes first flight. Now, back in March, we reported that the Sky Courier had successfully completed initial ground tests. But, Rob, we have another major, apparently successful milestone here.
Yeah, and the Sky Courier, of course, is Cessna's new clean sheet twin turboprop that will be either a cargo airplane or a 19-seat passenger airplane or a combination of both. But it's the first new turboprop that has been created by, in fact, it's the first, turbine-powered airplane, brand new, with propellers on it from Cessna. And I think I said today, I think a generation or something. I can't remember the last time, maybe the Cessna 441, which was back in the, I don't know, when was that, the late 70s or something? So they haven't done this for a long time, but the only reason they did it is because there is a market out there. And Cessna knew it because a lot of the FedEx contract carriers that are flying caravans right now had been calling for something that would carry more that also had two motors on it. And this is, Cessna's answer. So, again, I don't know how long the flight testing is going to take, but I would imagine we'll see this thing certified sometime next year.
FedEx is the launch customer for the Sky Courier. They have 50 firm, 50 option orders on the books. And, yeah, it's kind of interesting, this common platform that can support different configurations, like you said, Rob, a freighter, a 6,000-pound payload freighter, or a 19-seat passenger version, or some combination. Scott, you've got multi-engine experience. What did you fly with more than one engine?
Mostly low wing. So I grew up flying the Archers, the Seminoles, and Archer, all the Piper aircraft group, of course, Archer, Arrow, then Seminole, and it was pretty forgiving aircraft, luckily. But every time we would do spin training, we'd always get into Cessna because it liked to spin a little bit easier.
One of the things I found intriguing about this aircraft was the number. This is the Cessna 408, which is perfect because it looks to me like they took the Cessna 208 and they hung a second engine on it. And what's kind of interesting about this as well is that this is a high-wing twin-engine aircraft, and you just don't see very many of those around. You think about all the prior Cessna twins, all the ones I can think of were low wing. And this really does look quite a bit like the Cessna 208 Caravan. Very similar shape. One difference is it's got a T-tail as opposed to kind of a more conventional tail with a horizontal stabilizer down at the bottom of the tail. But I think that it's going to be a great successor aircraft for FedEx. FedEx, of course, purchased probably fully half of all the Cessna 208s that were ever built. So they have a huge number of those aircraft. And this looks like it's going to, you know, work really well as an almost, you know, plug and play aircraft, just kind of plug it into their program and do all the same things, but carry more weight and have an extra engine.
I wish I'd had Max around this morning when I was writing that. I would have thought about competitor aircraft, and really the only, this looks a bit like an old de Havilland Twin Otter. Mm. And of course it looks a little more streamlined than a Twin Otter, but I would like to have checked out the specifications to see what the difference is as to whether, because of course Viking is still making those. I don't know how many they're making, but it would have been, but it doesn't matter. It's already published, so I'm stuck.
And when I first heard about this aircraft, I remember thinking, oh, this will be similar to Denali, which is their new single engine turboprop. They'll of course include the Garmin G3000, but they didn't. They went for the Garmin G1000 NXI. And when I first heard that, I thought, okay, so that's going to be a little bit less expensive. Makes sense if the target's a cargo aircraft. But I just now realized that also makes it almost identical to the Cessna 208. So all the pilots that have been flying the Garmin G1000 and the 208 are going to already know the avionics when they jump into this airplane, as opposed to having to learn a new set of avionics.
Yeah. Does that mean they'll just need to take one quick iPad course in order to be qualified?
Oh, that's the way it is. The second engine, all you need to do is just read about it on your iPad.
That's what Boeing wants you to do anyways, right?
That's right. Yeah. Sorry. I couldn't resist a little dig there.
Did sound like a 737 MAX dig. Yeah. No, they'll definitely do more than that.
Hey, I got a few of those on my ramp as well.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the impacts on aviation of the COVID-19 virus. One topic is if airlines are requiring passengers to wear masks in order to board the plane, and what about in flight? And what we see is the policies are inconsistent across airlines. American Airlines policy says customers, quote, may be denied boarding, unquote, for not wearing a mask, while United's policy allows boarding in most cases, but the policy says, quote, there could be an isolated situation where a customer may be denied boarding as a last resort. And then JetBlue says, customers who refuse to comply with our policy will be denied boarding. Southwest policy says, has the word requirement. There's a requirement for passengers to wear a mask. But a memo that CNN obtained states that, this is from Southwest, that, quote, we will not deny boarding solely based on a customer's refusal to wear a face covering. And also, you are expected to inform customers of our face covering requirement, but are not expected to be enforcers. Ask the customer to comply with wearing a face covering if they are able. So what about passengers after they've boarded the aircraft? Well, American Airlines told its pilots, once on board and off the gate, the face covering policy becomes more lenient. The flight attendant's role is informational, not enforcement, with respect to the face covering policy. Bottom line to the pilots, a passenger on board your aircraft who is being compliant with the exception of wearing a face covering is not, and that's in capital letters, is not considered disruptive enough to trigger a threat level one response. So the inconsistent policies is kind of problematic, I think.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week in terms of, you know, inconsistent policies. The way I look at it is I think airlines should be happy that anybody is coming out to fly. So I can't imagine that they're going to be real sticklers on some of these things. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if there's a known set of standards that makes sense to assure the best possible health, then, yeah, it would be nice if that were uniform. But, oh, well.
I think it's about confidence, right? I mean, you're just trying to build confidence in your flying base. I'm a very frequent flyer myself, and I want to make sure that I'm not going to be harming anyone or anyone harming me. So I think even going on the conservative side here and a little more strict on the policy will help at least people feel a little bit safer. But then again, you don't want to be getting the bad press and being the enforcers as well and kicking someone off a flight, because you see that all the time in the press and social media these days.
That's right. Have you flown lately, and how crowded are the flights if you have?
I have not. So I the last day I flew was March 1st, coming back from an aviation conference, which a lot of hands were shook and a lot of people were having drinks and enjoying their time. And so it was all over the world. And so I if anything, I was probably one of the early ones to stop flying. And about a week later, we were pretty much grounded from our side. I've been driving back and forth to Arizona and California ever since.
Yeah, I would just think it'd be common sense and a responsible practice to wear a mask, and considerate of other people as well. That's the big thing. But not everybody looks at it that way, for whatever reasons, I guess. But I agree that asking the flight attendants to enforce a "you must wear a face mask" policy is kind of a problem. And obviously, there are times during flight where you can't wear a mask, like if you're eating a meal, for example, having something to drink.
You got to imagine the drink sales are going to go down with the masks on. So all the low-cost carriers charging for cocktails are going to be get hit hard.
Yeah.
And I recall one carrier said that they were going to suspend all service. I think that was Southwest, so no snack service, which to me kind of makes sense, certainly for the short flights that they tend to have. It'd be kind of annoying, I guess, to go coast to coast and not have anything to nibble on.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I had a feeling that somehow the folks at the airlines were hoping the FAA was going to take a stance on this. Okay. and decide either yes, everyone will wear a mask, kind of like the you will wear a seatbelt, or else, and then, you know, the flight attendants and the cockpit crew would be fine. They would know how to deal with the situation. You don't put a mask on, you're out of here, baby. But that never happened. And as we see with so many in between policies, you get lots of in between definitions of it. But like you, Max East, if I were on an airplane, let's even say we're separated in the middle, and everybody's wearing a mask except for two people, and one of them sits next to me, I'd be upset, because it is about, you know, people will look at it and say, well, it's my right not to wear a mask if I don't want to. You're right. That is your right. However, as you said, it's about being considerate of other people and the fact that you're not the only person on the face of the earth. And there are lots of conflicts with those two issues battling each other. But I agree, the people in the cabin are not the ones that should have to enforce that.
Yeah.
My favorite mask story is one I read on Facebook a couple of weeks ago. A lady was shopping, and somebody came up to her and said, "You realize that wearing that mask isn't effective, don't you?" And the lady said, "Well, I'm an ER nurse. I just came off duty, and I'm wearing it for your protection, but I can take it off if you'd like." She said the lady virtually ran down the aisle to get away from her.
Oh, that's good. That's good. All right. Well, we see an item in Reuters on Airbus. Airbus executives were told to, quote, face reality, and that Airbus may not survive without change. It says radical, proactive, and urgent steps are needed, particularly if the pandemic produces a second wave. Maybe similarly, there was an interview on NBC television with Boeing CEO David Calhoun, and he was asked, "Do you think there might be a major U.S. carrier that may have to go out of business?" And he responded, I don't want to get too predictive on that, but yes, most likely something will happen when September comes around, which, of course, is when the restriction on firing, furloughing, letting employees go expires for those that have, you know, accepted government money. I think that we're in certainly a tough period. When Rob and I were on the call with Isaac and a bunch of others last night, I used the term airline Armageddon, not trying to be, you know, dramatic or alarmist or anything, but I really think that's I think that's where we are.
Oh, I think you're right. And Airbus was warning about the fact that they were in dire straits as early as the beginning of last month, because they seem to have seen the handwriting on the wall much sooner than Boeing did. But then Boeing, I can't remember what it was. Boeing was a little involved in something else at the time. So maybe they missed that writing. But again, since day one, really, of all this, the folks in France and in Germany have been painting really ugly pictures for the future of the second airliner maker in the world.
Well, it could be just as ugly potentially for Boeing. Somehow I'm reminded of the old phrase, which is that when the economy catches a cold, that aviation catches pneumonia. In this particular case, what happens when the economy catches pneumonia?
Aviation goes on a ventilator.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Aviation has always been highly cyclical for all kinds of reasons. And yeah, I think they're going to be among the industries to be suffering the worst of all the industries in this particular case. That's the way it's always been historically. And with this sharp a downturn, yeah, it's totally unpredictable as to what the outcome is going to be, other than that we know that anything is possible.
I think you're going to see a lot of change in the aircraft makeup and what an airline actually looks like, right? Are you going to see these big, huge network carriers, or people finding their niche with, you know, only a few aircraft types versus someone like Delta flying 10 different types and keeping those maintained? So I think you're going to see kind of a right-sizing event from the efficiency side. And maybe they were propped up a little bit before due to the low fuel prices and booming demand. So it's kind of didn't really have to do the best they needed to do. So I think maybe low-cost carriers may be even coming out a little bit better because they've always been that lean model.
And what happens when businesses decide that, hey, you know, these Zoom calls work pretty well. We probably don't need to put people on airplanes as much. I think that's probably going to be as big a factor as anything. And certainly people are going to keep their leisure travel to a minimum until they start to feel safe. And that might not be until we have a vaccine. So, yeah, you throw in all these things, it's a very complicated equation. And we just don't know how it's going to end. But right now, there's certainly a lot of, you know, bad outcomes that could occur.
Yeah, and we see that Delta is getting ready or has announced that they're going to retire their entire fleet of 777s. You know, they're just not seeing a long haul business being viable right now anyway. Scott, when you read something like this or see something like this about Delta retiring its entire fleet of 777s, what reaction do you have? Is your reaction, oh my gosh, where are they going to put all those planes? Or is it, hey, we've got some spots right here. Let's talk. What goes through your head?
Well, yeah, I got a few of those aircraft on my field as we speak. Obviously, short term, you think, okay, how can we help Delta out, of course, but it's kind of when someone like Delta does it or someone like an American does something, it's definitely a leader across the board, right? So it makes you think about the entire aircraft. Like, are the 777s even viable beyond this to a certain point? And you start looking at the rest of Delta's fleet, and they got A350s, you know, brand new A350s off the production line. They got brand new Airbus A220s. They're still flying 717s for whatever reason in the short hops down in Florida and all the islands. So it makes you wonder, did we get too big too quick? And where are we going to start doing with some of these things? You saw a similar with the Airbus side. On the A380s, there's a very short-lived program. Produced some really great cabins, but not a very good economics for the four-engine operators there. So it just makes you wonder what the future of the future aircraft looks like in the future I guess, service and future airline.
Well, when an airline or an operator or an owner decides to park aircraft or take them out of service, are there different categories of duration for storage? In other words, I mean, just parking an airplane short term, and then there's plans to store them perhaps for some specific period of time, and maybe there are others that just intend to leave them there for some undetermined time. Are there different categories, you know, in your business that define the types of storage?
Oh, absolutely. And it seems the airlines have been doing a little bit of mix of everything. Obviously, parking is the, or active parking, as it'd be called, is the easiest thing to accomplish. And it's just more or less running the engines and doing some visual inspections and ops checks every week or so. Becomes pricey to start running engines and APUs and doing those system checks all the time. But it's usually kind of a line maintenance or a maintenance base type of operation that you would do. So sadly enough, we've had a lot of 737 MAXs in active parking since this time last year. I imagine maybe Boeing is going to have to pay for that or something. But the similar situation is those ideally could be activated within days and flying again for revenue very quickly. So it's usually kind of that quick knee-jerk reaction is to throw them in active parking and let's decide what we want to do. The next stage would be kind of a short-term parking, as we say, and it depends on the OEM, whether Boeing or Airbus or Embraer or Bombardier, what they call it and the durations. But the usually it's between 1 and 3 months. You kind of figure your aircraft's going to be out of service, so you do a short-term preservation of the engines, the flight controls. You disconnect batteries where you can, temporarily cover tubes, cover sensors, you know, getting the gear just inspected visually. The idea there is that if it's going to stay in 2 to 3 months short-term storage, that then you can bring it out within a week or so, a couple of days usually. You'd hope to get it back in the air. And then the one no one wants to do is long-term storage. And that's where Boeing has an option up to 1 year, over 1 month and up to 1 year. There also is an over 1 year option as well within the AMM, the aircraft maintenance manuals. And those would usually involve full preservation of the engine, or we call it pickling of the engines. So draining all the fluids, making sure the preservation oil is put in, fuel tanks are inspected and checked. Depending on what environment you are, you might put protective surfaces or protective coating on all the surfaces to prevent corrosion. Being in the Southwest in the desert, we don't usually have that issue. You want to disconnect all electricals. You want to seal up as much, all the breakers you can possibly do, all the sensors you can possibly do, seal up and landing gears, really getting it ready for weather, for animals, for anything else you can think of that would cause that detriment. And basically, in a long-term situation, you're going to put it there and you're just going to check on it every couple of weeks and really just do a visual inspection to make sure your covers are secure and things like that, versus a short-term, which will every 30 or 90 days, you'll run that engine and making sure it's still in an active kind of situation. So the further, I guess, you put it into storage, the more upfront work it is, but the longer it takes to get back out.
And the requirements are established by the OEMs, by a Boeing, yeah, or an Airbus or the engine manufacturer. Anybody else involved?
Sure. I mean, it's obviously the aircraft comes out with an AMM, and then operators usually follow that for a little while. The bigger operators have their own engineering groups, and bigger operators have their own storage programs too, that they've done this a long time as well. As long as they can prove that they have the data or the knowledge or the engineering background to do this, they may be able to eliminate steps or change steps. It's the same. I mean, storage in itself and even parking is a maintenance program, right? So it's actually an approved maintenance program by the FAA or EASA or whoever the registration is. So whether you're just following the AMM, which is very simple, but it might be a little more costly than your own program, it's still got to be approved by the right authorities, and we have to follow it by the right authorities. So, yeah, a lot of places are boneyards or parking lots, but we're actually a maintenance provider first and foremost. And right now, storage seems to be the maintenance game.
You know, something I've always wondered, you mentioned that preservation oil earlier. What is in that stuff that preserves the motor?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, you're probably asking the wrong guy. I was an aeronautical engineer. I'm not a materials engineer, but...
Okay, so it's... We'll skip that one.
Well, it's really just for anti-corrosion, anti-fungal properties is usually what you're trying to do. Same thing if you put additives in the fuel tanks. You're really just trying to protect and lubricate anything that you would normally get while you run the engine, where you get those protections. But you want to make sure it's just like it's wet from that moment and it can last a longer period of time without being cycled.
And that came up when I had Mike Bush on Aviation News Talk recently. And as I recall, he said that the oil is stickier. So it kind of,
yeah, that's the word I remember.
The cylinders longer, doesn't run down, off them. And that's the key element. I also asked him if he could continue to run it afterwards. And he said, yeah, you actually could fly away with it, but you should change it out, pretty soon. It's not really meant to be used long-term if you start to fly it after it's pickled.
Scott, who are the customers that are likely to want to store aircraft? I mean, besides the current situation, before the pandemic, there were still aircraft being stored there. What aircraft are they, and why are they being stored?
Well, I mean, I think nobody wants to store an aircraft, right? I mean, that's the exact opposite of what an aircraft is supposed to do. So, I mean, typically, let's say, last year and a few years before, we were probably less than 100 aircraft on site. And right now we're about four times that amount. So in those situations, when you're less than 100 aircraft, usually aircraft are stored for short-term, basis. So leasing companies transitioning from one operator to the next operator, they haven't quite found the next one. Or if they repossess an aircraft from an operator that went insolvent, so they might have to, do some work to go find the next home for it. Other ones are just fleet types that are more on the, let's say, on the back end of their useful life. A lot of four-engine aircraft. Previously, we had a lot of 747-400s in our fleet for over 15 years that a major operator had there for quite some time, but they had book value on it. So they were just writing down book value, but the operation to keep them in the air became too expensive for the business case that they were flying them on. So it made more sense to just write off the book value in the desert in a storage program. Now they would try to sell the asset and trade the assets as they could, but only when the price kind of made prices right, so to speak. Since then, I think, let's say another year later in the end of 18, and you started seeing some more, let's say, classic narrow bodies, 737 classics, older Airbus A320s starting to come down as well, as you started seeing the ramp up to the Neos and Maxes, people getting excited for those. So you really started to see, let's say, some, let's say, 400s and 500s and 737-300s littering the areas. Sometimes they would be bought and sold for conversion into cargo. A lot of 737-400s made that cargo route. Same with the 747-400s are really ideal cargo carriers. And so those things, they had low cycles, and you could find some engines were usually ideal candidates. But then flash forward to now, and it doesn't really matter what's out in there. It seems to be everything's parked at the moment or stored at the moment. On my facility alone, I think we have 10 different types that have landed in the last 2 months. Anything from a CRJ 900 or CRJ 200, sorry, to a now 787s are sitting. I mean, so it's just, there's really no business case to fly at the moment unless you're flying cargo. And we've had a few of those come in and out as well prior to this. So it seems to be, let's see, what flies out of this is really what you're going to see left behind is the ones that are going to have trouble funding those business cases.
Do they do any of the dismantling of the aircraft there once they're, someone decides that they're no longer going to have a life of flying at all?
Oh, absolutely. So we were most of our aircraft that were in our quote unquote storage were headed towards dismantling prior to this whole event. So we run the dismantling operation there. We don't do the parts sales and things like that. It's not really our wheelhouse. There's a lot of third party companies that do that. So a lot of times the leasing companies or the operators will sell them to the part companies, and we do the dismantling themselves. You don't need licensed mechanics. You don't need anything like that, because it's just really taking a part off an aircraft and, pracking it. And now we do have a part 145 arm. So if they want us to run it through our testing arm or do a hang an 8130 on it or an EASA Form 1 on it, then that'd be a different story. But yeah, we do about, say, 3 to 4 aircraft a month in teardown down there. And prior to this, and there, you know, earlier this year, it was really booming business. There was everything was flying out there. There's a really big demand for what they call USM, or used serviceable material. And that's where, you know, because obviously, and you guys have worked for OEMs or in the past, I'm sure Pratt, when he charged a pretty penny for all their engine material on the aftermarket. So what do people do and the airlines do? They started buying USM, started servicing them themselves. They started doing PMA parts. So the OEMs, when they got bigger and started tapping into this market, kind of created their own competition there, because there's always all this material out there. So we were doing a lot of teardowns of pretty common aircraft, 8320s and 737s. The newer would move pretty quickly. You'd have about 1,000 parts off each aircraft that would be taken. Obviously, engines and landing gears are obviously the key ones, and those have cycles and overhaul capabilities and things like that. And then you started digging into flight controls, and at the tail end of any kind of things, you might even do a cut of the aircraft for a simulator. You might even do a cut of the aircraft for a training base, to do crew training and simulation. You could do cuts for people's walls or novelty tables. But generally speaking, we were moving them pretty quick until this, and it slowed down a little bit. But I think right now you're going to see a lot of assets sitting on the ground and people wanting to, let's say, scoop them up now when they can. So when people start flying again, they're able to kind of, let's say, capture that market.
Is it a buyer's market for those kinds of things now?
Absolutely. Now, I it depends on each company's business case, but if you have capital right now and you're looking to invest there, I think that would be ideal. Obviously, I wouldn't buy an A340. I don't think A340s are going to fly too much, or A380s per se. There's only a handful of them left, and Emirates just slashed, I think, 40% of theirs as well. So now talking about 737-800s, talking about A320s, less than 10 years, between 10 to 15 years, you're going to see those things flying for a long time. Also, some of the older assets, which a lot of common parts, like an A319, they're not a great moneymaker, but they have a lot of common parts of the 320. So a lot of people will gobble those up and start dismantling them there. Now, regional jets haven't been as popular, but some people are getting into those too.
I'm curious. We see pictures of airports with just dozens, if not hundreds, of airliners lining the runways. How does an airliner choose whether to, plop their aircraft in an airport where they've got lots of gates versus bring them out to you?
Yeah, I think, you're kind of defining what's the difference between, hope and not so much hope. The airports themselves have kind of transformed themselves into these parking areas and storage areas. Now, obviously, airports depend on the actual municipalities, depend on landing fees for revenue, right, and gate fees. Now, they're not getting the landing fees that they were before, so they can't keep all their staff employed. So what they did, they shut down a runway here, they shut down a runway there, taxiways. They have all these light maintenance spaces there, so they have mechanics that can go service these things. So I think you're seeing a lot of these short-term storage and active parking in the kind of the main aircraft hubs, especially right away. But now, as you're starting to see this thing drag on a little bit, you're starting to see less viability, let's say, in Tornado Alley, or as hurricanes starting to hit the south, you're not going to start parking these things there longer term. Or when you start getting into corrosive environments, you want to pull them out of South Florida. Now, you might have a base there, you might have a maintenance hub there, but you have to worry about the environment. And I think you're seeing with the different types of aircraft, like I think you see Delta parked all their A350s pretty close to Georgia. I mean, they're all within pretty good radius of their maintenance services. I think you're going to see the ones being actively parked as the ones the customers expect to fly the first.
It's pretty humid in Georgia. I mean, do you think that the airlines would get to the point where it's gone on for so long that they really prefer to get them off into a low humidity environment, for example, someplace that's more environmentally suitable for storage that's maybe lasting longer than they originally expected?
Yeah, I think you're seeing them. It's more of an active maintenance, so you're ongoing maintenance all the time, so it costs you more to keep it there short term, but it's easier to get back into fleet as you're flying the aircraft, I guess you would say. You'd have those same inspections, same areas you're going to check. You might have to do a little bit more prep and a little bit more protection than you would in a long-term storage, but I think you're seeing you can keep your own pilots and own maintenance people qualified on the aircraft as well.
Is there sufficient storage capacity worldwide? I mean, are owners and operators scrambling for where are they going to park these aircraft, or is it pretty well settled out?
Well, I think if you ask, you know, kind of what kind of storage, if short-term storage, yeah, I think you're kind of seeing probably the peak of it in the States at the moment for short-term storage. Now, if you asked everyone to put in a long-term storage, what they have in short-term storage, I think you'd find a lot of places struggling to keep up with that. Prior to this, our biggest competitor was Boeing 737 Maxes, because they had a huge block of mechanics they put at the Moses Lakes, Washington, and of course in the parking lots in Renton, keeping these Maxes in those active conditions as well, because they want to deliver it once the FAA gives them that green light. But now you're seeing kind of mechanics all over the place due to the issues, let's say, at the regular maintenance bases. A lot of things aren't going through heavy maintenance checks. A lot of things aren't going through line maintenance. So mechanics have been pretty readily available, which is really, I mean, other than just a big piece of land, you really need a lot of mechanics to keep these aircraft in the protected state like they are. Because, like I say, we're not a boneyard. We're a maintenance provider.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's maybe one of the things that a lot of people may not realize, that it's not just simply a matter of parking them in the desert and then, you know, waiting for them to return to service. That there is an awful lot of active maintenance that has to go on while they're there.
I'm trying to raise my hand. I wanted to see if that would work.
I see a finger.
I couldn't figure out where to put it. It's disgusting. Anyway, do you get many airplanes from outside the U.S. parked at your place?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think we have, I couldn't count the countries, but I know at least over five continents. We just got four A330s from South African Airways today. And usually what drives that is leasing companies. So, I mean, some operators will park, you know, in our desert for long term. We had some old Lufthansa's there for a long time. But other ones, usually it's where they expect to kind of transition the aircraft and the best market to sell the aircraft usually. So a lot of leasing companies will pull aircraft out of South America. They might pull aircraft out of Asia and then bring them back kind of to their quote unquote home turf when they expect them to either transition through FAA. In our case, we also have EASA certification. So when we bring an aircraft back into service, we can issue the EASA Form 1s that we need to, and the EASA release, Part 145 releases, as well as an FAA release. So I think you'll see leasing companies drive to their known areas with the best chance of trying to get them back into service, or with the best options. Like for our case, it could go into heavy maintenance and to paint, or we could take it down the way to reclamation and do teardowns as well.
Well, the European aircraft that are parked, I mean, they don't really have a desert kind of climate, a place that's dry that they can park aircraft anyway, I don't believe, do they?
Yeah, the pretty big one in Spain. It's a kind of a joint venture between Airbus and a couple other ones. The company's called Tarmac. And they have a couple of places in France as well, which do some teardowns. They've been the kind of the only place, and that just came up in the last 15 years, actually. Usually the deserts in the Southwest were kind of the key location. Australia's got a pretty big booming base now with a lot of the Asian market coming to there. China's trying to expand into the high deserts in China, trying to serve their own markets. And so it's really, I mean, it's also about trust. Like if an aircraft is sitting in the desert in Africa, would you trust the part that came out of it, or do you trust the aircraft that came out of it? Or did you take it to a place that's been doing maintenance for over 50 years in a very robust market like the U.S. Aviation market, that you could trust that an FAA Part 145 has been certified and the ongoing maintenance there has been done. So it's really building up that level of trust. Doesn't happen overnight.
Well, I would think that aircraft owners, whether it's the airline themselves or the lessor, would like to have the aircraft in probably the most economically safe and stable, you know, place they can have them, you know, lest they run into, you know, problems with, you know, people stealing the aircraft or running off with parts or something like that.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm sure it's happened at some point in our history, but yeah, you never know. There's always a linchpin or something like that missing from something on the landing gear. But yeah, exactly. Security is ideal. But like I said, just the safety is always going to be the first when people start thinking about that.
Now, I was really impressed when you mentioned that form, EASA Form 1. I mean, most forms have like 4 or 5 digits in them. This must be an incredibly important form if it's the very first EASA ever came up with.
Yeah, it kind of shows you the bureaucracy, right? Because the FAA is 8130 and they're Form 1. So they decide which one's going to be done first.
Yeah, Scott, I wanted to ask you, you know, when you see images taken from boneyards, you see a lot of aircraft that have, of course, had the engines removed and, you know, many other components removed, and it's just sort of the hull. Does the hull have any residual value? I mean, why aren't the, you know, those tend to be, you know, recycled, melted down, the aluminum used in other applications?
Yeah, usually that's just the mixed metal or recyclable market price of aluminum. If there's a big aluminum demand, usually in China or in other areas that do a lot of the recycling, then you'll see those hulls move a lot faster. Right now, if you take down a hull, it can only net you a few $1,000 on a 747 after you've taken everything out of it. So it really, I mean, doesn't do a whole lot just because of the processing value. The movement of it takes so long. Now, if I had a beer can facility on my plant, which, hey, maybe I will do that now that I thought about it.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. But it really did take a lot of processing time to get it to move all that mixed metal aluminum to where it needs to be in order to be, I guess, salvaged. And usually the parts you'll see on the aircraft usually are the interiors, things that get changed quite often that don't have a whole lot of value, in the kind of 70s shag carpet brown that you'll see on some of the carriers. Not to date you guys or anything, but so
no, I've got some of that stuff downstairs, actually.
I think Rob had some in his basement until something happened.
It's a little used right now, but that's okay.
Yeah. That's good. But yeah, so I mean, really, the mixed metals, I mean, people will pull everything they can off things to a point where it stops becoming economical, right? If you assume it's going to cost you $100 to go pull that off and then ship it somewhere and go, you know, put it back into circulation, it better be worth more than $100.
But if I were looking to chop off the front end of a 737 to make a flight simulator that I'm going to put in my backyard that my wife knows nothing about right now, would be a good time to try to get a deal on one, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're going to see people trying to move anything they can. And then, like I said, sign logistics programs. Generally, the industry doesn't like to keep inventory, right? So you're not going to see a lot of people, you know, chopping up airplanes and putting 10 widgets on the shelves when it costs them money to do so. People that might want to leave inventory on the aircraft, they might buy an asset, leave it in a preserved state or keep it in a stored state, which is as minimal cost, only to start tearing it down when the market's right.
Cockpit instruments are probably the first things that are going to get pulled out and sold, right? So by the time Rob comes along, it's going to be pretty empty cockpit.
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, there's some screens here, and you got to understand a lot of seats go, because on an aircraft, there's only two seats, right? There's a left and a right in the cockpit, whereas you have, in the cabin, you have 200 of them. So you can pick any one. So you get the things that are kind of the ones and twos of the aircraft usually go pretty quick. Obviously, the engines are where the value are. The gear goes last, because then you got to put it on blocks and railroad ties. But everything else usually is kind of the left control, right control, things like that. You don't see a lot of those cuts of the cockpit until you might see one a year kind of thing, because you only need one or two simulators. But by then, you got to start rebuilding all the components and start to might be a little bit difficult.
Scott, does Ascent Aviation do any freighter conversions?
We have not done ourselves yet. We've worked on a couple different projects these days, looking into viabilities of this. So we've had a couple prior to this COVID, of course. A321s was a very ideal program. I think you're going to see more 321s enter that program. 737-800s. There's been a lot of talk about getting those into the freighter conversions. This is kind of the replace, let's say, the older MD-80 type conversions that you were seeing before, and the DC-9s, which are still flying quite a bit. We would see a lot of 747-400 freighters. I think you're not going to see as many of those, but they're still very viable for Atlas and companies like those who are very good at doing that. And they still have a ton of storage space inside of it for the dollars it keeps to lift. But I think you're going to start seeing that next wave. As you see, like you said, 777s losing their commercial viability, you're going to see a lot of those 300 ERs go into those type of conversion programs.
I'm curious, maybe you can scale this for us a little bit. I think in the beginning of the program, we said that you had somewhere on the order of 400 plus aircraft. How many, if that's the correct number, how many have come in just the last few months?
Probably 300 of them. So,
yeah. Wow.
That's yeah, I mean, we have between three customers, we have about, let's say, almost 200 of those aircraft, just between three customers. And that's really just a big sizable portion of their fleet. Some of them are headed towards retirement from their fleet. Now they'll find home somewhere else's. Other ones, you're not seeing as many. One of our operators is just retiring their whole 767 fleet because of this. You know, they could have commercial viability somewhere else. They might go conversion. A lot of the Amazon Prime is taking all those 767s off people's hands. So you can imagine people like them with a lot of money right now are just going to scoop in, and Prime Air is going to, primarily what they fly right now is 737-800 and 767. So they can expand their fleet quite a bit and not rely on FedEx and UPS.
Scott, one of your facilities is at Victorville. Is that right?
No, that's our competitors. But
oh, that's your competitors. All right, well, scratch that. Never mind.
Oh, it's okay. No, they're big storage area too, and a lot of logistics. That's all the logistics go into Southern California. So a really big airport, a lot of desert area. Boeing has a big facility there. They do a lot of maxes as well on tarmac. So yeah, between the Southwest, there's only about three main ones: us, Victorville, and then Roswell, New Mexico, are the three main hubs.
That's right. Victorville's in California.
Yeah,
which is not the same as Arizona.
Yeah, California thinks they own it, but
Does do you do tours? Is there anything to see?
Oh, I mean, we got quite a bit of aircraft. I mean, it depends on your audience. Would probably love it, of course. You see some 737-100s. You'll see a lot of those. You'll see MD-11s. We see a lot of. We have some firefighting tankers out there that we've done conversions for. We got a 747 Global Tanker that our facility used to be the old Evergreen Airlines facility. We did the Evergreen mod on an old 747 there. So, yeah, we were Evergreen, and then we became Marana, and then now we're part of Ascent. So we have a big history of 747s and a lot of aircraft that came down knowing our 747 prowess then too.
What about any other business activities that Ascent is engaged in that we haven't looked at?
Well, I mean, we've done a lot of. For us, the sky's the limit because we have you said at the beginning, we're a Class 4 MRO. They don't give out the Class 4 designation anymore. It's one of those things we're kind of grandfathered in, and we'll always be. So what that is kind of a self-governing body. So we have obviously report to the FAA and authority there, but we're able to add things to our capabilities a little bit easier than others are, as long as we can prove we have the tooling, prove we have the capabilities and the training involved. We can kind of add capabilities left and right if we need to. So we just added the 787 to our op spec recently due to the storage issues. But I think what we're actually seeing is going to be a need for, as you said, conversions, but also a lot of LOPA changes or the interior changes and transition of these aircraft from one to the next or from type for different types. So we're doing a 767 right now that's going to fly around a major sports team. So it's going from a 240 PAX configuration from an Asian, defunct Asian airline, going into the U.S. to fly NBA teams in 88 passenger configuration with stateroom and a lot of other things that go along with it. So I think you're going to start seeing more specialty projects like that for people with money. I think you're going to see a lot of configuration changes from, let's say, a regular mainline hauler to a low-cost configuration as well. You might not see that three-class configuration anymore. I really don't think you're going to see first class as much as you used to. There's going to be a couple of Singapore Airlines and Emirates aircraft that are going to be doing it well, but I don't think you're going to see Delta and American Airlines offering first class. They might want to pack it more with business class or more with a premium econ. So I think you're going to see a lot of changes on that front to people, how they do business. And then, like I said, I think you're going to see low-cost carriers, if they have the capital, gobble up younger aircraft, because they were always into that second and third generation of leases, you might start seeing them get a little bit newer fleet and start, I guess, doubling down on their business model because they have the capital.
Hmm. And of course, you come from an interiors background. So, yeah, you bring that experience with you.
Yeah. And I think it's, but you also, in the end, you're going to see people saving wherever they can, right? So you don't want people to, I mean, American kept on doing a new whole theme change every 2 or 3 years. I don't think you're going to see them do that necessarily. You're going to try to find it easiest. You're not going to see a lot of, let's say, major engineering upgrades that they don't need to do. The actual heavy maintenance themselves, they're going to go to the limit of that when it's needed. So I think you're going to see, I think, a different way of doing business and doing the minimal required.
What about freighter companies? I had read that we have lost a lot of our freighter capacity because so many passenger airlines used to carry freight and now they're all grounded. Are you seeing any demand from the FedExes and UPSs of the world for additional freighter aircraft at this time?
Yeah, so one of our main customers is Atlas Air. We do a lot of what they call HX, which is like a 3 or 4 day check of an aircraft. They also have what they call hot spares programs, and they would have, usually after the big Christmas rush, they would have some aircraft sitting idle and going through some maintenance overhaul. And you kind of saw that again, and you saw it a little bit of aircrafts kind of sitting for a while because of the COVID happened in China first, so nothing was flying from China. But once that picked back up again, those aircraft were nowhere to be seen. They were constantly in the air. They've been flying almost nonstop recently. And you started seeing some of the passenger aircrafts just being converted quickly, and you're taking a row of seats and putting in some storage areas, using the belly storage in some different configurations as well, operating just storage-only flights, which obviously don't make them any money, I can't imagine, but keeps their pilots flying, keeps their name in the news. So yeah, I think you're seeing FedEx and Prime Air and all the ones, and now Sun Country flying for Amazon Prime as well. A lot of these people just going to keep flying and flying and boom as you go.
Do you get a lot of critters that make it into the airplanes, even though they're all buttoned up?
Oh yeah, I'm sure our customers, hopefully they aren't listening right now, but there's definitely, at least in the Southwest, we don't have a ton of, let's say, human environment animals. But most of the, let's say, AMMs are written towards keeping birds out, right? Because they can do the most damage once they're in there. They can nest in areas and things like that. But being in the Southwest, of course, we got our fair share of snakes that make their way in and around, let's say, shaded areas in the summertime, because our temperatures will be in 110 and more sometimes in the summertime. So in the shade, they'd be ideal for certain times of the day. Our security staff on site is actually trained in snake removal from various areas of our facility. And we average about a couple per week. They used to have a snake metric from our last operations officer. We have how many snakes we've captured per week and relocated, let's say, to the further desert in the area. So yeah, we've had our fair share of snakes and tarantulas and Gila monsters and all sorts of things that would excite some people. But the good thing is rattlesnakes can't climb, so they're one of the few snakes that cannot climb, so you're not worried too much about finding them in the wheel well. But if you do find a snake up there, it's usually non-poisonous, so that's okay, but it might give you a little bit of a scare.
What's the most bizarre thing you ever found in an aircraft, living or otherwise?
Oh, I mean, so we have these things called javelinas out in the Southwest. They look like a wild pig, but they're more related to a rodent, actually. They're peccary family for those animal enthusiasts around there. But you'll find those things all over the place, kind of in the Southwest. And usually it takes a lot to get into an aircraft, right? So those things are usually just the things that can slither through something, or insects that can get in there. But yeah, you find those things all over the park sometimes.
Wow. As far as tires, the rubber, we haven't really talked about that. Rubber tires and windshields and plexiglass, things like that. Special preservation for that?
Yeah, the first rule, of course, especially being in the Southwest, is cover, right? So everything is covered with Mylar. All of the windows from the cockpit and throughout the cabin are covered as best they can. And they have to use certain types of covering, certain types of tape, obviously spec'd out, I'm sure, and charged 5 times the normal amount, as would be aerospace aerospace grade, right? Just put a new part number on it and then you're good. But yeah, and same with the rubber. The wheels are always kind of checked in each weekly check and in each monthly check for tire pressure and for just kind of rolling them so they don't get bald spots and certain things like that. Because obviously you don't want to have those issues as you start reactivating. But yeah, really the key is cover and lube where you can, keeping the rubber lubed with certain material certain times a year is really the key to preserving those long term.
Okay, I have one last question that's really been driving me crazy. Is there indeed an aviation grade duct tape?
Well, I don't think it's called duct tape, but I'm sure it's a yeah, there's definitely Scotch brands, different kind of tapes for all over. Now, sometimes the AMN lets you use industry standards, which aren't as, you know, pricey as some of the other ones, but it's similar to speed tape, right? As they call speed tape. I'm sure Max East there from the Pratt & Whitney has heard of speed tape before, but that's what you'll see on the, if you look out your window and you're kind of had a maintenance problem on your engine, you might see a mechanic putting a speed tape on that to get it to its next location. And I can tell you, we've had some planes come in from, let's say, certain countries in Africa that have had a lot of that attached to it, pretty much holding on the aircraft. And I think we expected an aircraft to land in Florida on a, let's say, a 3.5 engine flight from Kano, Nigeria. And they didn't land in Florida because they weren't sure they could get off the ground again. So they got it all the way to Arizona, and we're doing a D-check on the aircraft as we speak. So, and then bringing it back into service. So yeah, we definitely see some of those, let's say, engineering solutions all over the world.
Creative solutions.
Well, at least exactly. When it's 3.5 engines, it doesn't burn quite as much gas. So the
I'm sure you're saving quite a bit at that point.
I've never heard of a 3.5 engine aircraft. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it made it quite a way. So it made the whole trip. So it's not too bad.
All right. Well, Scott Butler, Chief Commercial Officer, Ascent Aviation Services. Want to thank you for an interesting conversation. I think. There's certainly more to this than some people might think, and it's sort of fascinating to learn all the details and the aspects of what it takes and how it's not just simply parking an airplane, walking away, and you're done. So I want to thank you for spending some time with us and helping educate our audience.
Good talking to you, gentlemen. I appreciate the aviation enthusiasts out there.
And, of course, the website is ascentmro.com. Any other social media places that people might be interested?
Yeah, you find a lot of our work on a LinkedIn, as most of our stuff's done. So a lot of great aerial shots these days of the aircraft filling up over the last few months. Please come check us out.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Let's start with Max Trescott. What's new with you?
Well, what's new is I've been talking about commercial maneuvers. So we just kicked out to episode 149 of the Aviation News Talk, and we talked about the commercial check ride. It is kind of interesting. We've done a couple of these in the past with Jason Blair, where he's given me kind of a mock oral check ride for the instrument and then for the private. We did the commercial, and since the oral portion of that is in some ways very similar to the private, we concentrated on the maneuvers instead and just really talked in detail. How do you do lazy eights and chandelles and steep spirals and all that fun, cool stuff? A lot of subtlety to it. Turned out to be one of the longer programs we've done just because there's so much to talk about for each of these different maneuvers. But I wanted to encourage people, especially if they're still at home sheltering, or even if they're just starting to come out of it, to consider getting their certificate for the commercial. And the reason I say that is a lot of people, I think, just get their private and their instrument and they say, hey, I'm done. And yet I think there's a lot of benefit by just continuing to move on and try new things. And for example, in my case, I was happy that I had done my commercial simply because it was out there, kind of the next thing to do. And years later, when someone said, hey, you should become a CFI, it was just easy to do that because I already had all the certificates I needed to proceed to work on the CFI. So anyway, I just want to plant the seed out there. Anybody who hasn't really thought about doing the commercial, maybe is now a good time to just think about adding that to your list of goals.
Some people seem to collect these things. You know, I see some people, some pilots that, you know, get one and then get something else and get seaplane rating, then get this, then get that. And it's sort of like merit badges to some people.
it's sort of like fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to say, it probably makes you a better pilot, right? The more you learn.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you look at the maneuvers in the commercial and, wow, they require a lot more precision than for the private or for anything else. So, yeah, it's a good way to improve your skills.
Rob, you've got a lot of merit badges, don't you?
A couple. You know, it's funny. As you were just saying that, Max West, I was thinking that what those do for you subtly is that when you fly with somebody else, you quickly, even though you may not be doing it on purpose, you watch how precise they are. And you see people that are really, really sloppy and you think, oh my Lord, how did this man get a certificate? And then you see other people whose habits are so good, you think they must have been flying professionally, and you find out, no, they just always had they always run a pretty tight ship from the day they got their certificate because they took it very seriously. Me, I liked learning. So to me, it wasn't easy, but I enjoyed the process of learning more, even though I don't think I've ever taken a check ride that I wasn't nervous about before I took it, especially my first typewriting ride. I didn't think I'd get through it, but I did. But it's really an enjoyable thing. So I agree with you. I think that looking at it as a way to improve your currency, be current, more current. What's the word I'm struggling with? To become recurrent plus, maybe is the way. I mean, if you're going to go through all the trouble after having been on the ground a long time, you know, push yourself a little bit. Try to be better than average. I mean, all we ever do is meet minimum standards anyway. Why not meet better than minimum standards?
And I've always felt that anytime you're dealing with something that could possibly kill you, that's a good thing to get really good at. You don't want to just be average.
I think the average would disagree with you there.
That's why I got rid of my first wife, but okay, we won't go there. Boom, boom. Okay.
I thought she got rid of you.
Yeah, well, all right, something like that. I mean, picky. Oh my goodness. No, I agree. It's going to be tough, I think. I think it's tougher than most people realize. I was out flying about 10 days ago and I hadn't flown in, I'll bet, a month and a half, and it was weird. It was just weird. Not bad, but just strange. I didn't feel like I kind of belong there, maybe because I hadn't been in the cockpit in so long. But for people that have been sitting on the ground a lot longer, trust me, you want to go fly with somebody and let them run you through some of the things you think you know pretty well.
And I think that brings up an important issue as we start to unshelter and open up. For folks who haven't been flying a lot recently, they really ought to think about what their approach to getting back in the cockpit is going to be. And for some of you, it might be bringing a flight instructor along with you, especially if you're relatively new to a pilot certificate or you don't fly that many hours per month. Think about not perhaps doing it on your own.
Yeah, it's kind of like the aircraft ascent, right? You're not going to just fire them up and fly them away. There's a process to making sure that they're airworthy, and same for a pilot.
Yeah, well, a lot of our some of our customers are keeping the aircraft back just to keep their mechanics and keep their pilots and flight crew all up to currency. Especially like we have the one operator that has 737 MAXs on site. And they've never flown 737s before this, so they've kept a few of them back on base just to give them a little bit of a head start once they get a little bit of a whiff of it coming, because they're going to need a month of proving out all their crew just to get it in the air prior to it getting approved by the authorities. So, yeah, it's definitely learning, and recurrent learning is always key, right? And so,
yep, you want to stay proficient because the alternative's kind of unthinkable.
Well, that's been the hardest part about our group now is we have so many different aircraft types on field. We have to be able to service those aircraft types. Talk about an aircraft mechanic that's working on a CRJ-200, then goes over to a 777ER with ETOPS certifications. It's a little bit different kind of ballgame. So,
yeah.
So do your mechanics, when they're hopping around from airplane to airplane, do they carry a lot of material, say, on an iPad or some sort of tablet that they can easily access it?
Yeah, so we have tablets that most of our leads have that are connected to our database, which we control all the maintenance manuals through. So when they have to access those manuals from one to another, obviously based on the task card they're given, they can go back to it and do that. And we have our own training facility on site as well. The FAA actually uses our training facility also. So we go through a lot of mechanics each month on different, usually yearly recurrent training for every major aircraft type. And some customers require, you know, more than just a 1 week course. It might require a 2 week course every year just to work on their aircraft. So it's constantly a training battle for mechanics as well as pilots.
Hey, do you ever get into any augmented reality to the system mechanics?
Well, there's a couple of things hitting the latest. Obviously, augmented reality is a really unique one. People are trying to look inside the engineering side of the those components. And the hardest part of us is getting people like Pratt & Whitney and people like Safran to give you the engineering drawings of those components, because then you're in the PMA world. But another thing we're doing, which is interesting, I think, and we're not quite there yet, but is doing drone inspection of aircraft. So doing dent mapping and all this other inspection of the fuselage and the area by drones and cameras, and having a guy like us sitting on a computer and having either kind of a program look at it or certain people look at the pictures and have it do this full mapping within a, you know, let's say one shift versus what it would take three or four shifts on a normal aircraft. You can imagine a 747 takes quite a bit to physically look at every single fuselage piece and every single fuselage area and start doing measurements and RVSM measurements on those type things.
And I've never heard of dent mapping before. Is that important so that people know that you didn't damage the aircraft or that you document what it was like when it came to you? Tell us about dent mapping.
Yeah, obviously that's one thing. It's topical, right? So if you have chunks out of the paint, that's a spot for corrosion that can start going into areas. That's the number one obviously thing you're looking for. Little things like rocks kicking up and here and there don't do too much. But really, you're looking at it mainly for where your sensors and your like a pilot static system is reading. So you have to have a certain level of smoothness, or they call it a waviness test. I don't know exactly what the technical term is, but a waviness test around that area, that making sure that there's no major divots, so the air flowing over that is reading what the programmed PDOT system is supposed to read. So you can imagine in areas like that or another, and you see a lot of dent mapping, especially when it comes into transitioning aircraft. So when it's going from one operator to another operator, you want to make sure you're getting it kind of the rental car as you walk around and making sure no dent's bigger than a half inch or whatever they tell you at Enterprise. So yeah, it obviously causes issues in some areas more than others.
Got it. And so all these aircraft, by and large, are at RVSM type altitudes. So that's why you're going to be doing that around the pitot tube and static ports and things like that.
Exactly.
Boy, you really either have to learn or you do learn a lot about aircraft and aviation working at a company like Ascent.
Well, I think you touch so many different parts of that aircraft. I mean, we do a full, like say, a D-check on a 747, which takes us, you know, 3 months and, 20,000 mechanic hours, maybe more. I'm tearing that thing apart and putting it back together, upgrading insulation, and something as simple as changing a seat cover versus, you know, going deep into a fuel tank, electrical systems. We have different sub-disciplines that do things, you know, like sheet metal or do things like composites or electrical systems, but you kind of have to be a generalist in understanding at least what that aircraft is. And my background helps me a little bit there with the engineering side. And I've seen most parts of that aircraft at one point or another in my career. So it's definitely fun. Like I said, we get to play with aircraft in all different shapes and sizes.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you currently adding to the employment roles?
Oh yeah. So in the last, I think this time last year, we were probably doubled in size, mechanics wise. And that's been more of we couldn't get mechanics this time last year. We had the big pilot shortage and mechanic shortage the last decade or so. It's been very tough. And now we've got a lot of mechanics and a lot of work. So we've been able to really, I think we're over almost 300 mechanics in Murano and 120 in Tucson. So we're over 400 mechanics between both sites. And we've added probably about 100 in the last 2 months. So we're one of the booming areas right now.
And so we've talked a lot over the last couple of months about, you know, downsizing of pilots, downsizing of flight attendants. United has talked about, you know, perhaps putting, you know, 3/4 or more of their, you know, staff, you know, on furlough and so on. I hadn't even thought about mechanics, but I assume the same thing applies there. And there are going to be a lot of mechanics on the street, and there already are some.
Yeah, so a lot of people use contract labor for mechanics when they just over the years. It's a common A&P test. It's a common thing. So the union, you know, they don't want to get too big in size because it's quite costly at the major carriers. So they have a lot of contract help. So immediately when a lot of this stuff happened, they shed a lot of that contract labor. So companies like Launch lost 50% of their business overnight, almost within a few months. But on our side, that's just kind of a boon for our side. We were able to pick up a lot of mechanics that we previously wouldn't have been able to pick up. And heading into the summertime in Arizona, where it gets pretty warm, we were able to grow really quickly in order to maintain the steady income of aircraft. And some of these aircraft, like I said, let's say a Delta type, they laid off their own contractors, and we were able to hire them already with Delta training and hire them with familiarity on those aircraft types and that aircraft program. And kind of a win-win for us.
Cool. All right. Rob, what's going on with you? Anything interesting? You and I were both on the Zoom meeting last night that Isaac has been running. I guess that's a weekly roundtable thing he's got going there.
It is. In fact, my spies have told me that he's thinking of calling it the Real Airplane Geeks, but I might be wrong. There's, you know, those sources these days, it could just be fake news, but, no, it was a lot of fun actually, interacting. I mean, they must've had 15 people on there, I think.
Yeah. 15, 16. Yeah. A crowd.
And I took part in one, last, Tuesday, and he does the same thing, but he focuses on Europe and Asia. And so he had people from Britain, from France, from Germany, from there was somebody from Tel Aviv, you know, just all over. And some of the topics are the same, but then some of them are very much different because they're dealing with different crises, although everybody seems to have an awful lot of airplanes sitting on the ground, not too terribly far away from them. I mean, we're lucky here in the States that, depending on how you read it, you can go fly a GA airplane, but a lot of countries, I mean, like England, not going anywhere, baby. They are grounded and they don't know for how long. But anyway, you know, and of course, the other thing, as we started to talk about earlier, was that when you get water in the basement, that is no fun. especially when you've tried to make your basement a living area. A finished basement, and carpets don't like water very much. A little bit when you're trying to wash them, but not when you can see the surface of the water above the carpets. No, it's not good. So I can hardly wait to go back home tonight and go back downstairs in the basement and get busy putting junk in plastic bags. But that's about it. That's probably going to take me another, I don't know, 8 years or something to clean up, I think.
Yeah. My basement floods from time to time. But see, I've got a dirt basement. And when it floods, the water just goes out a pipe in the base of the foundation.
Don't you get critters down there?
Not so much.
Ever go down there at night, though, and go, what was that noise?
No, I don't go down there. It's scary as hell down there.
You mean even in the daytime, right?
Anytime.
In California, we don't have basements. It's nothing we have.
I was just going to point that out. When I moved here 30 years ago and bought a house here, I was kind of stunned. It was like, wait a minute, where's the basement of all the houses we looked at? I don't recall ever seeing a basement in any of them. So,
are you in California too?
I am up here in Northern California. The only thing I can guess is it was to, you know, reduce costs, and that, you know, houses, you know, go up faster that way, and they're expensive enough as it is. So why not make them less expensive by not digging basements?
I think there's seismic issues as well when you start thinking about what fault lines you're near.
That's a good point. A good earthquake could turn a 2-story house into a 1-story house if it had a basement.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap this episode up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Wait a minute.
I thought you were done.
Scott Well, I am. We didn't ask Scott. So, Scott, what are you doing these days?
Just trying to make room for aircraft these days. But, you know, I'm looking forward, as anyone, to see them flying again, to be honest. As much as I like what it's done for our business, I'd rather see them in the air. And being an engineer and a pilot, like I said, it's kind of makes you sad when you see them on the ground. So
it is indeed.
I wouldn't mind a beer at a bar too, right? So I am a pilot, so it's
yeah, it goes hand in hand. Yeah,
and when you build that beer can facility, don't stop there. Go ahead and get the brewery next to it as well too.
That's right. Something to pour into those cans.
Yeah, one-stop shop.
All right. Scott is Chief Commercial Officer with Ascent Aviation Services. And again, you can find them at ascentmro.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes, we have a handy link that redirects right to this episode, which is airplanegeeks.com/604. All right. Max Trescott, where do folks find you?
At the usual place, coming out to aviationnewstalk.com, headquarters for our podcast. And if you want to shoot me an email, just click on contact there at the top of the page, and you can shoot me an email, or better yet, go ahead and click on the listener question, and you can record a message for use on the show.
I keep thinking I got to do that someday.
Okay.
I have to think of the right, you know, crank question to ask you. Something where to... I'll have to think about it. Rob Mark, where do we find you online?
No, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Well, we already know I'm going to be in the basement for quite a while, but I think you meant something different than that. You'll find us at jetwine.com, along with Scott Spangler, who is our editor, and they'll also find me between the pages of Flying Magazine. So we'll try and keep people entertained that way. And all of our news is... news. It's all factual. We verified it all. No fake news.
Excellent. Excellent. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. I'm also on LinkedIn with David Vanderhoof at the UAV Digest, talking unmanned aviation, and with Mary Kirby talking the passenger experience on the PAXX podcast. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye.
Nighty night.